Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for our Venture Law Meetup webinar program. This month we're talking about a startup's guide to insolvency. And with me today I have two co-presenters, my colleague Peter Morrison and also Howard Klein, who is a partner at Markham LLP. My name is Leah Brownlee. I'm of counsel in the corporate group at Squire Patton Boggs. And, you know, a little bit about my background. I work primarily with, you know, early to mid-stage companies that are growing their businesses. And I do a lot of outside general counsel work. And how I got to this is I've, you know, worked with startup companies over my entire career, from working with a startup while I was in undergrad, to working in an incubator in law school, and then as a service provider to startup companies. After that, with a 6-year stint in-house at a company as well. And so, you know, I see a lot and get a lot of questions coming from executives that touch on a number of items. And often, with respect to insolvency, I do get questions, and it's as frequently from my clients as maybe once a month or even more frequently. And so, you know, we wanted to present this topic because it seems to be a little bit of the elephant in the room when we're talking about, you know, a growth stage or an early stage. And I'll ask my co-presenters to introduce themselves as well. So, Pete, can we start with you?
Hi, I'm Pete Morrison. I've been practicing for about 10 years here at Squire in the restructuring and insolvency group. I work with companies and banks of all sorts, on all types of matters related to insolvency, both in court and out of court. And Leah and I work closely with her clients, with her startups, on insolvency issues that they face.
I'm Howard Klein. I'm a partner at Markham. I've been a business advisor for over 40 years. I started at Ernst & Ernst. I went to a local firm. I was a partner at Skoda Minotti until we merged recently with Markham. So I've had a diverse career in different size firms I've worked for and different size clients. I've had large clients and startup clients, and I've been a business advisor all those years, but have specialized probably in the last 30 years in bankruptcy and the insolvency world.
Thank you. And, you know, a big thanks to both Pete and Howard for joining and helping with this month's presentation. Also, I want to thank our co-sponsors for the program. We have 13 different co-sponsors that are listed on the slide, and Markham is one of the co-sponsors, which is how we're connected with Howard. They have a depth of expertise and have, I think, helped out with 4 different programs so far. It's a very valuable resource, both for our clients and for us. So just to kick things off, you know, I mentioned in my intro that it's the elephant in the room. When a company forms, it's exciting. It's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of promise, a lot of what ifs, and, you know, the amount of money the company can make, the millions of dollars the founders might be able to get, you know, all of the potential that's out there for the company. And it is a really fun, fast, and hardworking time in a company's life. But 90% of startups fail. And so oftentimes I will have, with the same client, over the lifetime of our engagement, both the conversations about how to form the company, the planning for their financing rounds, and also the conversations of how to strategize as they're running low on money, or if they have a technology failure or a market failure, what the appropriate business thing to do next is, how they should plan their future for the best, you know, for the best outcome for their shareholders and their business. And so at those times, when they come to me as a lawyer, I often next call Pete or send him a message while I'm on the phone and see how soon he may be available to talk to the client, and really formalize this by calling a board meeting and getting the advice and the thought process in writing when we go there. So today we're going to be talking, a bit about what that looks like, what the advice is, and how to handle insolvency, not only when your company is facing this type of challenge, but when someone that you're connected with, whether it be a supplier or a customer, has these challenges, and they may affect your business. Just a disclaimer, insolvency and bankruptcy law is very state-specific. So we are today talking about Delaware law, but depending on where you are, you really need to ask the advice of your counsel because the law is different from state to state. And so this is a kind of a generalism presentation, but for the specifics, you really should ask your advisor. And then a quick overview, because we use some of these terms on the slides throughout. A debtor is the company that owes money. Typically, that may be the client that we're talking to that doesn't have enough money in their bank account to pay all of the bills that have come due. And the creditor is the person to whom money is owed. So it's the person who sent the invoice that may not be being paid and may be being paid. And then I'll ask Howard to say a couple words about insolvency and what it is. And now Howard's the accountant, and typically the lawyer is not the first person that knows the company is insolvent, but oftentimes I think the accountant.
And that is true. So we have on the screen what is insolvency. What also goes in hand is a distressed business. So a business could be distressed and not insolvent, or which can happen many times. So you may have cash flow problems, but by definition, you're not insolvent. So when we talk insolvency, you're usually talking the common definition is when your liabilities exceed your assets. That's the definition of insolvency. So you could have a distressed business where your assets are still greater than your liabilities. The problem is your assets aren't generating enough cash to pay the bills. So a distressed business can be solvent, to be on its way to insolvency. So just when you look at the bankruptcy code, the general definition is for insolvency, your financial condition where your entity's debts are greater than the property at fair value. Of course, fair value can be very judgmental. We use three approaches. Let me backstep. So the most common method to determine if you're insolvent is a balance sheet test. There are other tests. You could have the cash flow test or a capital adequacy test. But normally, we use the balance sheet test. And if you're familiar with valuations, the balance sheet test falls into that same category where there's the income approach, a market approach, or an asset approach. I'm not going to get into the details on how you compute it. That's a whole class within itself. And then, of course, when you're doing a valuation of insolvency, you have to know what premise are you under. Are you under when you value your company, are you looking at it as a going concern or as on a liquidation basis? Values would be different. Assets are different if you can sell it as a going concern versus if you have to liquidate it. So that's basically general terms of insolvency. So then the question is, when do we use insolvency in the bankruptcy environment?
Right. And so I want to ask a question first. I think oftentimes my clients may be insolvent on paper. So an early stage company takes a convertible note, say $1 million, so that they have cash to conduct their business, but they don't have any assets left yet, or they haven't developed their assets so that they're very valuable. Is that a concern yet to you as an accountant, or how do you parse between seeing that type of situation and seeing the situation where you might be going into bankruptcy?
I think it all depends on how distressed the business is. as opposed to the formula approach. If you're still able to pay your bills, then you're okay. If you're now if you're distressed and you can't pay your bills, then we look at see how insolvent you are and what are the creditors, who's knocking at the door.
Right. We talked about how, your lawyer might not be the first to know. It might be your accountant. But really, it might be you or your bookkeeper who's running the company and realizes that you're putting over bills from one day to the next or from one month to the next, and you start to feel the distress, and then the distress becomes insolvency.
So when you're avoiding phone calls,
yeah,
hoping your supplier doesn't email you.
It's possible to have a plan that your business plan very likely lays out the fact you're not going to make a profit for a very long time.
Right.
Not making a profit doesn't mean you're insolvent.
Okay.
And at times, I mean, on paper you might be insolvent but not in distress,
mm-hmm.
and that's obviously going to impact the go forward of your business and whether it can.
So when does solvency become an issue in bankruptcy? Three major reasons you do solvency tests in bankruptcy. One, once you get into bankruptcy and you're about to reorganize, and we're going to get into the different levels of types of bankruptcy shortly, but you'll need a valuation for solvency coming out so you know how much the firm is worth on a reorg basis. The next reason you would need a solvency analysis done is when you go into bankruptcy, are you better to reorganize or are you better to liquidate? What is best for the creditors? Are they better off letting you reorganize and the company is worth more as a reorganized company, or are the assets worth more liquidating them? So you need to do that analysis. Third reason, which most people don't like, are preference actions and fraudulent transfer actions. If you're insolvent and you're making preference payments, those could be clawed back and taken away.
So can we dig into that a little bit? What is a preference payment versus a regular payment when you're running out of money? How do you differentiate?
So in bankruptcy, a preference is a very specific thing. It's a payment on it's called an antecedent debt, which is basically you pay an invoice for an obligation you've already incurred in the 90 days before a bankruptcy is filed. Once you file a bankruptcy, either you as the debtor in possession, which we'll talk about in a bit, or a trustee will look back at those 90 days worth of transfers and say, the company is presumed insolvent for those 90 days, and we're going to go back and demand payments back from everyone, because if you did receive a payment, chances are you were preferred in that payment over another creditor who wasn't paid during that period. So we're going to draw it all back in, those 90 days worth of payments, and then we're going to divide it out equally as creditors in the bankruptcy. It is what feels as though the most fundamentally unfair part about doing business with a company that's in bankruptcy, because you just went along in the normal course, in your opinion, and got paid, and then someone might come calling later to claw it back.
So that's really relevant in two contexts. So whether or not your company is hitting insolvency and might be looking at bankruptcy as an option,
mm-hmm.
but also when you find out one of your suppliers or your customers is getting in financial trouble.
Yeah, critical. And one thing to keep in mind, it's not a black and white that a payment is preference. There are exceptions.
Many
exceptions. And more times than not, you can get out of when someone files a complaint against you that you received a preference payment. There are good exceptions to getting out of that clawback. Ordinary course payments is one. New value is another. So you don't want to go to a loan. This is when you do pick up the phone, you call your accountant, and you call your lawyer to say, I just got a letter from the trustee who wants $50,000 back. Don't write a check for $50,000.
So this is clearly a way or a reason to spend a few hundred dollars or, on your professional advisors, because they can help you keep the money that you were paid someone whom you're doing business that might be getting into trouble. So not a commercial for our services at all.
No.
But Thank you for the intro to the insolvency. We're going to cover a number of topics in the rest of the hour, and we put a list on them here, so we'll cover as much as we can, but also for those who are on the line, you will receive a copy of the presentation, so anything that we haven't covered by the end, because we do have a lot of informational slides on that cover different scenarios that are great for reference, just in case someone who you're doing business with goes and gets into financial trouble. So the first topic that we're covering, this is the fiduciary duties during insolvency. So generally, when you're not insolvent, officers and directors of the company owe fiduciary duties to the common shareholders of the company. The basic fiduciary duties that are owed are the duty of care and the duty of loyalty. And that's under Delaware law, but they're fairly consistent across the other state laws. The duty of care, the basic formulation of the duty of care is, in essence, that the director should be competent. They should pay attention to what's going on at the company, inform themselves about what's going on. They should read the emails that are coming from executives. They should attend the board meetings. They should act as if they care about the company. That's kind of where the terminology comes from. So if you think of things like don't fall asleep in the boardroom, don't skip the board meetings because you're too busy, that's where we really find, the trouble happens with the duty of care. So that's a gross negligence. So you're kind of intentionally ignoring the company and not caring about them. And this exists in a bankruptcy context as well. So when the company that you're a director or executive of is getting into financial trouble, think of the things that help maximize the value of the company and be part of the solution, the discussions, the care of the company in this situation. So that may be, involving investment bankers in valuing the assets and seeing what the best value you can get out of this, what exists at the company today is. Inviting the bankruptcy lawyers. This is, very often step one with my clients. They tell me they don't have enough money for X. Sometimes it's payroll. they're running out of money. They have a concern. And oftentimes they tell me the exact figure left in their bank account, which is almost never six figures, almost always five or less. And the first thing I say is call a board meeting. So hopefully they have regular board meetings. Sometimes, especially smaller companies, there's a lot of work to be done, and they do a lot more unofficially. So if the three people on the board are the three people they usually work with, they might not find the need to call an official meeting and take notes at it and call it a board meeting. But in this circumstance, it doesn't matter if you sit in desks next to each other. To call a board meeting, you should take minutes of the board meeting. Peter's often in my clients' board meetings at this point, and he runs through kind of what the duties are and what the possibilities if the client really does run out of money, isn't able to sell to that next big customer, isn't able to raise that next financing round, what do they need to be thinking about? And that's how we help the clients satisfy that duty of care. Going on to the duty of loyalty, in a bankruptcy context, this is the trickier of the two. In general, the duty of loyalty is that directors must act in the best interest of the corporation. Pre-bankruptcy, that means the corporation and the common shareholders, and people talk a little bit about how the creditors come into that context post the bankruptcy filing or post going into being insolvent. But when the directors are taking action, it shouldn't benefit them themselves as a director. It should be at a, you know, arm's length transaction that avoids self-dealing to the extent possible. And if not possible, are very, very careful about it, and, you know, making sure that the full value of any sales transaction or any type of transaction, you know, is had by the company. Just, so it's, in essence, the best deal for the company if you're looking for selling off assets or selling the company as a going concern, and really valuing and having a process to figure out what that best.
The reason that we're focusing on duties right now is because if, as you run out of money, the board and management fall under a microscope of their creditors and perhaps a court-appointed trustee eventually. And when Leah says you want to make sure it's an official board meeting, it's because you want to be able to demonstrate to other people that you did what you were supposed to do and that you invited a lawyer and you took notes and then you wrote down that you brought the lawyer and you approved your minutes of that meeting. So you could hold it up and see I did what I was supposed to do. And that's because, principally, the duty, you may be, as a board member, you might also be a shareholder, right? You might also be the one who you feel like you're working, whose benefit you feel like you're working ultimately. But when you become insolvent, your creditors really are the ones for whose benefit you're working. Because every dollar you maximize in value of your company is a dollar in your creditors' pocket first before it's a dollar in your pocket. So much so that in most circumstances, once you're insolvent, a creditor can get derivative standing to sue the board as if they were a shareholder for breach of fiduciary duty. That's kind of the broader picture about why we care about duties here and why it's so important to talk about in the insolvency scenario. And this is whether you file a bankruptcy or not. You're potentially liable for this.
Yeah, and so I'll interject a little, but you know, I think the overall goal, and no, I'm a transactional attorney, not a litigator, but the overall goal is to avoid getting sued.
Yes. That's right. But it also, it really serves two purposes, though, because if you're exercising this duty of care, you really are doing your best at that time to cover yourself off from all liability of being sued, but also to try and save things and try to do the best by your company that you started. And that might be bringing in an investment banker who really does bring some new ideas and some new perspective to the room that might help you find a way forward. So, Leah started to touch on related party transactions. I don't know if it might actually make more sense to talk about the typical related party transactions before going to the best practices.
Yeah, I think that switch over to that slide. It gave a little kind of interest that when I said be as careful as you can, do it at arm's length. Well, oftentimes, especially for a smaller company, as Pete said, a director may also be a shareholder. It may be an executive that's a director, that's a shareholder, that has been, you know, helping to finance the company over time, and that may have some actual money or interest in the technology going forward. So there's different things that may happen. The first one, I'll touch on loans to the company. So maybe as the company is running out of money, you don't want to buy more stock because the chances is that you're going to lose the money that you invest. That's the risk. And so if the founder or executive or board members decide that they will loan money to the company with an expectation to be paid. And so while that can happen, and oftentimes maybe in the best interest of the company, so in the situation of we can't make payroll at the end of the week, it'll definitely stem the liability to actually have money to make payroll. But those loans should be papered, so you should have promissory notes. It should not be an email back and forth. It should be an actual legal document that is signed, and you should use market terms. So you expect to get paid back in a year, you expect a small, reasonable amount of interest to be repaid. You'll figure out when you expect to be paid back. Don't make it a 0% interest loan. Make it some reasonable market amount of interest. And don't make it a high interest loan. Right? And most importantly, get it approved by somebody who is not you as the person giving the money. Have other board members that don't have a financial interest do the approving, and have them have the conversation without you in the room that does the approval. And of course, take minutes and show that you did it in this manner. There's a very specific process under Delaware law, which is very similar to what I just described, but it's in essence, disclose what your interest is, recuse yourself from the meeting, have non-interested directors approve. If every director is interested, have non-interested shareholders approve. And it may feel like a bit of, belt and suspenders, but for any related party transaction, to the extent you can do this and do the approval in this manner, it changes the standard in a litigation that is applied. And so rather than you having to prove that your loan that you approved yourself was in the best interest of the company, the person suing the company, it shifts the burden so that the person suing the company has to then show it wasn't in the best interest if you do this procedure. Other things that may be related party transactions, many founders have more than one company. The one that's doing the best financially might lease the office space that all the other ones use. Papering the use of space, of lease space, hopefully paying for your portion of the lease. That should be done in kind of a documented fashion. And it should be kind of an arm's length fashion. So you shouldn't be charging much more for lease space than the available other lease space in the area. And you should not be giving away free, in essence. And then other services as well. So, with a group of companies that any one founder or other executive can have, you may be using services between the companies, all of which you should just keep the ducks in a row and put this down in paperwork what the agreements are, and then make sure that everybody's paying their proportional costs, and that those proportional costs are in the market.
And I will say, as a forensic accountant, one task that I am constantly being hired to perform, whether it's by a creditors committee or a secure creditor, such as a bank or the trustee, to go in, and one of the first focuses are on related party transactions. So, depending on who I'm representing, I'm going to try to take any loans on the books that are owed to a shareholder. I'm going to try to reclassify them as equity so that the creditors are paid first. And if you haven't documented these transactions, more likely than not, they're going to get subordinated to all the other creditors. So it's so important, as the screen says, document is so important, and to make sure you're treating it as arm's length transactions. If it's loans, it's interest rates, you're paying interest on it, or if you're not paying interest, you're accruing interest. Ideally, you're paying the interest. You're treating it as a true lender responsibility. Same thing with you shouldn't be running personal expenses through the business. Rent, if you're paying rent, they should be arm's length. They should be market. So you really have to document all this. And in addition to documenting, you also have to perform as if they're arm's length.
Yeah, I agree. And then the other one is that delay in salary. This is clearly not an arm's length transaction when the CEO or another executive says, I don't have enough money in the bank account to make my payroll, but I do if I don't pay myself. So you can delay salary, and you can do that in the best interest of the company. If you have any expectation to ever receive that salary, you need to account for the salary being due.
And you want to do this, if you know you're going to delay your salary, even in the very beginning, you really should document what is a reasonable salary up front and then accrue for it on an ongoing basis. That should be pretty standard in most of these companies because they're not the owner is not getting paid what he deserves to be paid initially.
Yeah, and I think that happens a lot of times, even in a different context when you're not going into bankruptcy or closing down the company, but when you're just starting your company, you don't yet have enough money to pay to people. If at that time you expect to be reimbursed for your time and effort, you should document the amount of time and effort that you put into the company, and you should accrue for the payment on the books. So when your first financing round comes in, so the person financing the company can see that it's an accrued liability, and you have a much higher likelihood that the investor coming in, an earlier executive, backs that amount.
By documenting up front, also, it eliminates the positive side that when you are become very profitable, the IRS won't come in and claim that your salary is unreasonably too high. That it's part dividend and part salary if you have documented all along that you've deferred your salary.
Yeah.
So there's a pluses if the business takes off, why you want to document this too.
Oh, great. Thank you. Oh, let me go back. I forgot we skipped forward. Talking about the related party transactions, so we skip forward to that just because they are really self-dealing and they're special transactions that seem to happen at a much higher frequency. But there are other best practices, when the company is reaching that insolvent stage. If you're a director, as I said, with the duty of care, show up to board meetings and participate in board meetings. One thing to note is that if you're an independent director and you're not affiliated with the company, otherwise an executive, et cetera, and this makes you a little queasy to be in a director of an insolvent company, it is not a breach of your duties to resign. But so long as you're active, you need to be exercising your fiduciary duties.
A lot of this is about avoiding the appearance of impropriety.
Yes.
We don't presume that even with these self-dealing transactions, these related party transactions, that you're doing something that's not in the best interest. The problem is outside third parties who come later, who do the forensic audits, who are looking to squeeze money from wherever there might be money available, are going to look at things that appear improper, and they're going to glom onto that and try and hold you accountable for it later.
Yeah, so the theme of the day, avoid getting sued.
Yes.
document.
Yes, absolutely. That's as a director. Management hopefully is exercising their fiduciary duties and reporting and keeping the board up to date. They should be doing that, and the board should be reviewing these reports and keeping up to date with what the status of the company is as it goes through this process. So, if you get email reports every week or every month, how do you document later when a forensic accountant or attorney is coming back, ask questions back in email, ask about the status. Don't just, say thank you. be engaged in the discussion if you're sticking with the company as a director throughout this process. Make sure the minutes are completed, so not just handwritten notes, something that is formalized that includes the participants, the time at which the meeting took place, who was invited to the meeting, and a summary of what was discussed at the meeting. And then that summary is reviewed by the board, and it's signed at the bottom by the corporate secretary, certifying that the board had agreed that the summary was correct. One thing to be a little bit of aware of in this context, earlier we had said invite your attorney. Board minutes can include information that's attorney-client privileged. And so if you are inviting attorneys to your meetings, if they aren't drafting the minutes, at least have them review it and let you know if there's attorney-client privilege information.
And if your attorney is there to provide legal advice, there is privilege, so take advantage of it. You can have open and candid conversations as a group with your lawyer if you're seeking legal advice. So, you know, just know that that exists, and that's a benefit that you have.
And to note on what privilege is, you're more in the litigation realm, so what privilege gets you?
And privilege means essentially that whatever you talk about with your attorney, if they're in the process of providing legal advice, cannot be discovered in the course of litigation. So if there is, for example, documented legal advice in the board minutes, that section of your board minutes would be blacked out before anyone else would get to, before you turn it over to anyone who's suing you. So it can't be held against you. You can ask sensitive questions and provide sensitive information to your lawyer and have confidence that others won't find out about it.
Yeah. And, you know, to protect that, you should make sure that any documents that contain that information just stay between the company and the lawyer.
Right.
They don't even get shared with Howard as your accountant.
Yeah, make sure you're clear with your attorney about it, and your attorney should have an eye towards privilege the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about inviting your lawyer, you know, having accountants, lawyers, bankers involved is really to your benefit as you go through this process, and it shows that you're doing your job and attending to, you know, the rights of the creditors and your shareholders appropriately. And obviously, and I think I've said it three or four different ways, don't just rubber stamp. So, if you're a board member, you don't have to agree to everything the CEO says. You can challenge, you can reach a different, you can have a discussion, reach a different conclusion, make the CEO go back if you don't feel that you have enough support to agree with what's been proposed by the management as being in the best interest of the creditors and the shareholders. Now, quickly, other things, ensure your officers are qualified to be officers. Now, oftentimes in family businesses, different family members may be appointed to different positions. That does not mean that, the CFO of your family-run business, if they don't have any other business experience or financial experience, may not be qualified to be your CFO, and that will be challenged. If you get sued. And you can think of different iterations on that example, but people should be qualified to do the job that you've engaged them. And we've already discussed a little bit on, how to be very careful if you have any self-dealing transactions. So if you can avoid them, do. If you can't avoid them, follow a process by which, that I described before, but just follow the process where it's an arm's length transaction that is approved by somebody who is not interested in the transaction.
So there are a number of ways that you can wind down your company or reorganize your business. We're going to come at this from the standpoint or the perspective of a financially distressed company. There are business reasons why you might want to wind down, and that it might be that your product is failing. It's not you don't ultimately have something to sell, or the business idea is just not working out. And it may not be that you've even used up all of your funding yet. It's just time to call it quits.
I actually met with a client yesterday who, I'm very impressed with because they decided to close their company while they still had enough money to pay all of their bills. To then hire lawyers and accountants to appropriately close down and dissolve their company, And while their shareholders will not be making a profit or even a full return on their money, they will get what's left in the bank account, and there will be an amount that's left in the bank account when they're done with the process.
So, yeah, and that is something that in the startup arena you might run into. But for our purposes, we're talking about financial distress and the options available to a financially distressed company when they need to either wind down or reorganize. The first you'll see on the slide in front of you is what we refer to as an informal wind down, and this is really ultimately a negligent way of closing your business. It is truly just stopping.
A good way to breach your fiduciary duty.
Yes, a fantastic way to breach your fiduciary duty. It is to just stop. You don't cease legal existence. You just stop doing. You stop conducting business. You run out of money. You don't answer your phone. You lock the doors. You default on everything. And
you make it somebody else's problem, at least temporarily.
Yeah. And it's not the right way to address. It might be a way you want to address it because it feels better to put your head in the sand, but this really is putting your head in the sand and much more likely to result in litigation with your creditors in the future, in the very near future. The second type is a corporate dissolution, which is a state law process. And Leah referred to this being a very state-specific issue. It refers to the state law dissolution and the requirements to wind down a company under state law. Most, if not all, states have a section of their corporate code that says, when you are done, here's what you're to do. And it includes filing the appropriate certificates with the state, distributing funds that are left in a particular order of priorities, which includes going to your creditors before the owners of the company. And there are, Howard can speak to this, but a number of tax requirements as well, right?
Absolutely. Final W-2s, final payroll returns, final tax returns, franchise returns, especially the payroll returns, because those are fiduciary responsibilities. You don't pay your final fiduciary taxes, your FICA taxes, your federal and state withholding, your sales tax. Those agencies could come back at you personally and go after your personal assets.
Yeah, and then a little bit outside the law, so going down the corporate distinction path and the employees that are being let go or the creditors that you're paying off or settling debts with, if they're amenable, do have everybody you can sign a document that saying that they don't have any claims against you. Or a release document that really clears the company in the future from claims against the people that you may, owe money to or may have settled debts with.
Absolutely. And the corporate dissolution is likely the cheapest, proper way of winding down your company. But this is a wind down. When you're done, there's nothing left. It's dissolved. This is not a reorganization or a restructuring in any way, and it will bring the enterprise to a close.
I know. I do believe in Delaware you have 3 years post-filing this dissolution paperwork before all of the liabilities or debts goes away. So you can file the dissolution paperwork before you settle all of your final debts, mm-hmm. and that's fine in the state of Delaware.
Okay.
Or for a Delaware corporation.
The next type on the next slide, again, a liquidation or a wind down, is what's called an assignment for the benefit of creditors. It's on this list because it's always on these lists of ways to wind down companies. It's very rarely used. In certain states, Florida, California, they employ this mechanism. It is where when all of the assets of your company are assigned over to a trustee for the benefit of creditors. So there's a fiduciary appointed who takes control of all of your assets and then winds down your estate. Distributes the assets. The assets are essentially held in trust while they're liquidated and distributed to creditors. It looks a little bit like a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, only it's a private process. The Chapter 7 bankruptcy is what we tend to see when when there's just no, there may be no ability to even wind down in a controlled way. It might be what you refer to as a crash landing, where you realize that payroll is due tomorrow, payroll is due at the end of the week, you have a note coming due that's maybe not convertible, or you're facing a foreclosure proceeding. You can file Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and that any bankruptcy, the benefit of a federal bankruptcy is it brings all actions against your company to a standstill. In the liquidation scenario and in the reorganization in a Chapter 11 scenario, there's an automatic stay, which stops all litigation, it stops all collection efforts. It just, it makes it essentially illegal for someone to attempt to collect against you for a period of time. If you file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, just like an assignment for the benefit of creditors, you're turning over the keys to your company to a court-appointed trustee whose job it is to maximize the value of those assets and distribute them to your creditors. It could be a very simple process. There could be one note holder who has a secured position and gets everything. It could be more cumbersome. This person is a fiduciary, though, and they might hire me and Howard to come in and investigate you. And this is one of those scenarios where it's important to have abided by your fiduciary duties, because this independent trustee will be looking for ways to bring in dollars to get to creditors, actually compensated by how much they're able to distribute to creditors. So
remember that that's an important point. Chapter 7 trustee who gets appointed in this case is going to get paid based on a percentage of what he distributes, or she, that whatever the trustee can recover, that trustee is going to get a percentage of it. So you want to make sure that you have documented, especially your related party transactions.
Yeah, and I would say this sounds a bit like an option to the first one. So don't walk away, put your head in the sand. Just because you're so frustrated with the board or with your business that you're done with this. If you want to do that, file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy first before you walk away if you want to watch
it. And you absolutely can. You can file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy and go home because you no longer have the rights to anything. You have no access to your own bank accounts anymore. You can't do anything. And the Chapter 7 trustee will immediately begin to wind you down. The opposite of that would be a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And that, in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you would remain what's called a debtor in possession. So you would be a debtor in possession. You would remain in control of your company. That gives you the ability to actually reorganize if there's a way to reorganize your company. And it might be that your capital stack is such that it's just it's crushing you and your creditors are willing to negotiate, and filing a bankruptcy just brings everyone to a standstill and brings them to the table. So they're willing to negotiate and find a resolution that could bring value to everyone, or at least increase, you know, or minimize losses, at the very least.
Tell them why Chapter 11 is so expensive.
Because of the professionals?
Because of the professionals.
So you do have to have a lawyer. You are going to have an accounting professional. In many instances, there will be a committee of unsecured creditors that's appointed, also fiduciaries, to on behalf of the creditors, in your case, to act as a watchdog. There will be no court-appointed trustee here to be that watchdog. There will be a committee of creditors funded by you, whose lawyer and financial advisor will be paid by you, to go out and investigate you. They'll be paying for your own investigation. It's expensive, but it can be a good scenario. It can be lead to a good result. Now, one of the things that goes unsaid in the bankruptcy code, but really what Chapter 11 is used for probably 50% of the time now, is to liquidate in a controlled fashion. Instead of liquidating everything in a Chapter 7, where a trustee will literally hold a fire sale, sell your assets that this person knows nothing about into an industry that they know nothing about, you have the benefit of hiring an investment banker and using your contacts throughout the industry to sell your assets, your company, your IP. It could go as a going concern. It could be broken up. But it gives you the ability to wind down in a controlled manner and to sell in a controlled manner. And the reason that people like to buy out of bankruptcy is you'll hear the phrase a 363 sale. If they get the benefit of buying your assets free and clear of all liens, claims, and encumbrances, they get a spick-and-span asset with a court order saying so. So no one can ever come back to them and question their ownership. No other creditor can come out of the woodwork later and say, no, that's mine, or you shouldn't have transferred it. It puts it all to bed and gives comfort to your buyers. So using Chapter 11 as a sale vehicle is very common now. And, you know, you can take a quick Chapter 11, could be 60 is very quick, but 90 days you could get out of a Chapter 11 if you needed to. But you also get the benefit of that automatic stay. You stop all the litigation. You stop all the foreclosures. You get the breathing room to decide if you're going to sell or you're going to reorganize.
And you're still in control. Still not in control. Like a Chapter 7.
Whole time. Still in control. You get, when you go in on the first day, you get a bunch of court, you can really file what's called first day motions, and you'll get court authority to continue to pay your employees, to continue to pay yourself, to pay your utilities, and keep your bank accounts, and do all these things you need to do in order to continue to operate your company. So it's cumbersome, but, you know, it's very useful when in the right scenarios. And finally, brand new is subchapter 5 to chapter 11. And Howard can speak on this more intelligently than I can, but the expense of chapter 11 has really frozen the small players out of the process. And subchapter 5 to chapter 11 is brand new. Goes into effect next month. Next month, I believe, don't quote me, it's February 20th or 22nd. Sticks in my mind as the data becomes effective, February 22nd. And basically, this is for small business. It's because small businesses usually under Chapter 11 was too expensive. Congress finally has realized this fact, and they have created this new subchapter 5, which if you have debt of up to $2.7 million, you may file under this new subchapter 5 code. And what happens is there's no creditors committee appointed. So there's no watchdog of creditors that you have to pay for, their lawyers, their forensic accountants, et cetera. What you do have to pay for is a new trustee in a subchapter 5. But basically the role of this new trustee is try to mediate with you, the debtor, to come up with a agreeable plan and try to expedite this whole process so you can reorganize. So it hasn't happened yet. We don't know what kind of experience we're going to have with this and how many people are going to try this new code. The U.S. Trustee Department believes there's going to be a rush in the third week of February of a lot of companies who have delayed filing a Chapter 7 are going to try to reorganize under this new subchapter 5 code. And I've talked to a couple companies, and they're considering delaying and trying to reorganize. So we'll see if this works. So you should keep this in mind that you shouldn't, if you're thinking of filing bankruptcy and you know Chapter 11 expensive, This may be another course of action you may want to take.
Okay. Can I ask you, you know, Pete and Howard, between the time that the board says we approve filing bankruptcy to the time that the kind of work is done, how does it vary across the different options?
Well, it takes time, typically, a matter of, if done the right way, a matter of at least a couple of weeks to file a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You can do a Chapter 7 bankruptcy very quickly. You could file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy in a day. All you need is corporate authorizing resolutions, fill out a form, and pay a filing fee. And you could crash in and then kind of prepare the rest of your paperwork. The trouble is you truly lose control the second you pull the trigger on a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. So, I mean, you got to have your things in order a little bit. You don't have the right to open to use your keys to your office space to go in and clean out your desk, for example.
Got it.
You're really turning off the lights and handing it to someone else. You want to do it in as controlled a way as possible, but it can be very fast. We filed an entire coal company into a Chapter 11 in 3 days last summer, and it was a nightmare, but we were able to do it because they couldn't make payroll on Monday.
As soon as that judge appoints a Chapter 7 trustee, that trustee has a responsibility to go in and secure the assets of the company, and you're going to be out real quick in a Chapter 7.
Got it. And then from a timeline, we probably expect the Subchapter 5 to be on about the same as the regular Chapter 11 timeline.
To file it? You could probably file it faster.
Pretty fast.
Yeah.
And the other thing with the Subchapter 5, they're expecting you to be in and out in 3 months.
Oh,
they expect it to happen pretty quickly, unless you're going to try to sell the company. But if you're going to try to reorganize, they're expecting these trustees to move the process pretty quickly.
And filing a Chapter 11 or a Subchapter 5 to Chapter 11 bankruptcy puts you in a bankruptcy court, which is a federal court, but a bankruptcy judge sits in what we call sitting in equity. The judge's job is to use the powers of the federal bankruptcy code to do what they need to do to help you reorganize. It's a debtor-friendly environment. It is, in a lot of cases, severely hostile to your creditors, and many bankruptcy judges are not friendly to creditors. So if you needed to crash into a Chapter 11 and say, even though there might be a lot of filing requirements that day, and you go in with just your petition and your filing fee and say, Judge, look, couldn't make payroll, give me 4 days, give me a week to get this stuff done, the judge is going to do it. That's why hiring, you need bankruptcy lawyers. You need a bankruptcy lawyer at the very least on your team if you're doing this. Don't trust that your litigators or your corporate lawyers can do this for you, because it is very nuanced, the bankruptcy code is very specific, and it's also a fairly relationship-based business where it's a small bar in your community and even nationwide. We know each other and we know how one another work, and we tend to work well together. So you want to really bring on the right professionals.
And I'd just like to emphasize what Pete just said. The judge in the bankruptcy environment is debtor-friendly. You should remember that. Not until you burn your bridges with that judge that he's going to go against you. The whole idea of bankruptcy is help you to stay your creditors and help you reorganize. It's not to help the creditors, at least initially.
Right, thank you. And so we're rounding out our hour now. So I had mentioned at the beginning that you will get a copy of the presentation, and a lot of it's meant to be informational. And reference material in the presentation where we talk about what to happen when other people that you do business with have financial troubles. But I think the quick couple-word takeaway for what to do is call your accountant, call your attorney. If you know that one of your customers, suppliers, lessors, somebody is entering into insolvency or a bankruptcy process.
Or they're just distressed.
Because you will save a lot of money by proactively addressing this problem and hopefully not have to pay back money that they have paid you as they go through a bankruptcy process. And pay attention. So if you run annual audits on suppliers or, have your employees let you know if something seems odd. You went out to visit them and all the lights were low and half the employees were gone. Tell people that work with you to raise red flags, because it really can save you a lot of time and money at the end if you can be aware of them early.
And we did talk about preferential payments, and Leah mentioned having to pay money back at the end. Don't let that dissuade you from taking a payment today. If they're not, just take the payment. We will help you try to minimize the amount you might have to give back one day. You may never have to give it back. If someone wants to pay you,
take
the money, and we'll deal with it on the back end.
That's right.
Right.
You're better off with cash in hand.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So we can leave you with anything.
Yes.
From a creditor perspective, that would be it.
And then just two quick commercials as we round this out. Next month for the Venture Law Meetup, we're going to be talking about negotiating and understanding capital investment term sheets. So in person, we will be at Tech Hive in Cleveland, and then we'll also have a follow-on webinar. And this one will have kind of reading material and workshop documents. And then another item, and this is from Markham, they have started a webinar series where they have a monthly spotlight on different emerging startup companies and kind of showing what those clients, what those companies do, and, you know, what value and innovation that they are bringing to the community. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for your time.